Hello and welcome to the Original Content Podcast. I'm Anthony Ha.
And I'm Daryl Etherington.
And today we're just going to do one thing, which is review the new series on CBS All Access, Star Trek Picard. Although, just as I was saying that, I realized that, Daryl, as a Canadian, did you watch it on CBS or on Amazon?
Neither. It's on Crave here.
Oh, really? Which is, wow.
Yeah.
So it is amazing to me what are the random things. I mean, because I feel like on the big stuff like Netflix, it's the same for you. And then once in a while, we get some really interesting differences.
Yeah, yeah. We have, like, basically Hulu and, like, Prime still exists here, and they carry every Amazon original. But then Hulu doesn't exist, and CBS All Access does exist. That's the weird thing about it, but just because of, like, pre-existing licensing arrangements, a lot of stuff funnels to Crave, which is operated by Bell, like, our big, one of our big telecoms here. So,
huh.
Yeah. Okay.
And so, I mean, you and I are somewhat nerdy men of roughly the same age, so I assume you watched Star Trek The Next Generation. I mean, what was your level of Star Trek fandom and experience before this?
So it was pretty considerable. Like, I had at least watched all of The Next Generation and all of most other Star Trek-related series, except for some reason Deep Space Nine. I never really got into Deep Space Nine. Super deeply. I don't know why, but basically every other series, including, like, you know, Enterprise and Voyager and whatever else, I've watched. And so I had that, but I also wouldn't call myself, like, a super fan in terms of, like, recall or, like, being able to, you know, remember, like, oh yeah, I remember this specific plot in this season or whatever. And, like, I knew, you know, I know stuff like, oh, Picard was a Borg, and I know Locutus and that kind of thing, but I don't remember the specifics of those storylines super well. So stuff like specific to the show, like Hugh, I was kind of like, do I remember this guy? I don't know. And then I would, like, Google pictures and be like, kind of, but it was, yeah, it's not like, oh yeah, every single little obscure call out that they would put in this, I was like, yep, that rings a bell with me, or I know deeply the lore around this thing. So I don't know if that is useful.
Yeah, I mean, I also am a pretty big fan, although I don't think I've seen all of any of the series except for Discovery, just not because I love Discovery, but because it came out more recently and there aren't that many episodes yet.
Right.
And of Picard, but I've seen probably almost all of Next Generation, almost all of the original series, and then significant chunk of Deep Space Nine, and then Voyager and Enterprise I've barely seen at all. And I've seen all the movies, most of them multiple times.
Oh yeah, movies too, yeah.
And partly the reason I ask is because I think a lot of this show seems designed to sort of hit that nostalgia button and that kind of Easter egg button. And I will say, even as somebody who's pretty familiar with the shows, like, I knew who he was. I wouldn't say I had, like, a tremendous amount of emotional attachment to him. But there is definitely some things where I'll be talking about the show with somebody, and they will point out, like, how this character who's on screen for 30 seconds was actually in Star Trek Voyager. And I think I like that. I mean, it feels like a show that and it's too bad that Jordan wasn't able to get caught up, because I'm really curious how this show feels to someone who's not a huge Star Trek fan.
Yeah, well, like, not to speak for her, but she gave us a hint that maybe it was a little bit difficult to access it without that existing knowledge. 'Cause, and I think I got the benefit of, at no point did I ever feel like I was lost in it, right? So there may be things, like you said, like where there's, like, a walk-on cameo by somebody for 10 seconds or something that I missed and didn't pick up on. But that stuff, I don't feel like, at my level of fandom, like, I didn't, it didn't affect the enjoyment of it, right? But I can imagine that if I hadn't seen at least, like, or all of The Next Generation, or at least you know, even if maybe I haven't seen it all, it's hard to remember. It's a long time ago. But if I, even if I haven't seen every single episode, like I know the general arcs of most of the main storylines that went on there. So I can kind of like, I get like, when whatever, like the situation as it is presented now, like the timeline and what's happened and where we're at and the relationship of everyone to each other, I get. And I don't know that there's enough in the show itself to provide you that, even if that's what the creators were aiming for.
Because, I mean, certainly I've seen some discussion that there was like a hope that this could be like a jumping on point for new potential new Star Trek fans. I'm not sure that it'll work that well as in that component. It's more, I think, maybe about getting people who haven't been excited about Star Trek in a while to come back. And it's interesting because it jumps ahead, you know, many decades from The Next Generation or pretty much any Star Trek that we've seen, because virtually all the new Star Trek over the last 15 years has been prequels of some sort or another, filling in gaps, doing weird alternate timelines and things like that. So we haven't really advanced forward in this future timeline in a while. And in some ways that creates an even playing field, because even if you've watched every episode of Star Trek, you don't actually know what this world looks like at this point in time. In fact, there's a whole lot of backstory that they're working really hard to fill you in on.
Yeah.
But I think what doesn't work, so that part I think is fine. Like, you know, I think it's confusing, a bit confusing regardless of what level of experience you have. But I think emotionally it probably doesn't work that well, because so much of the show relies on you saying, oh, hey, it's Picard again. Oh, he's really different from the way he was in Next Generation. Oh, there's Data. Oh, there's Riker. And having that sort of sense of recognition and emotional attachment.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I think you're right about the plot stuff. Like, it is, and it doesn't really require any plot that it requires for the story itself. Like, they do kind of fill in. And yeah, there are major things that happen outside of the scope of The Next Generation or whatever, so that you're coming to it new as a fan, just as anybody else would be coming to it new, which I like and appreciate it about it. And you know, it was nice because it didn't feel like, although in some ways it would have been good to just be like, well, it's The Next Generation more, like that would have been cool as a fan of that, but that's not what they did, and I appreciate the approach they did take, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, it sounded like you liked it overall.
Yeah, I liked it overall. I definitely... It wasn't... I still preferred, in terms of, like, the new Star Wars projects that CBS has
new Star created. Trek.
Or Star Trek. Oh, my God. Don't... No email.
How
no
dare
email.
You?
Yeah, in terms of the two new shows, I preferred Discovery. You know, even as much as this was fan service and I was a fan of the originals and I'm a fan of Jean-Luc Picard, like I still am. I find the other one a much more compelling show. This one, I definitely feel like it was a little lumpy. Like it had its moments and then it had a lot of stretches where I was kind of like struggling to continue to be engaged or pay attention. And yeah, so I it was uneven is what I'll say, but on the whole, I did enjoy it.
I agree that it's weird. I hadn't sort of thought about putting them sort of head to head like that, but Discovery, which by all accounts has had a lot of behind the scenes drama, writers and showrunners quitting and being replaced, and you know, but despite that, I really did like most of the first season of Discovery. I thought the finale sort of kind of fucked things up a little bit. But overall, I thought the first season of Discovery was really good. Whereas Picard feels like, you know, it's Patrick Stewart. So obviously he knows what he's doing. And behind the scenes, it's a lot of the people who were writing on Discovery, plus Michael Chabon, who wrote Cavalier and Clay, which is one of my favorite novels of all time. So I thought this would just be like a complete home run. And it was not that. It's like in a lot of ways, it feels like a show that's figuring out what it wants to be as the season goes along, and kind of there are more productive like areas that it explores and episodes where you're just kind of like, what were you thinking? Why did you do that?
Yeah.
So like, on the whole, I still liked it, and I'm glad I saw it, and I'm glad it exists. But I do admit that I was a little surprised that in a lot of ways it wasn't stronger.
Yeah, yeah, I think so too. I felt the same way, and especially because of Chabon's involvement, I thought it was. I don't know if my expectations were like unfair, but I really thought it was going to be something special and more cohesive than what it was. And what it was it felt more like an extended plot line from like original Star Trek, right? Like, which in some ways is good, but it felt like a lot of, like, you know, basically they would try to like get through most stories in an episode, and it would be kind of like a, oh, what bizarre caper are they up to this week or whatever, right? Like, some weird thing has happened and they have to solve it. And like, this felt kind of like that, just played out over a whole season of episodes as opposed to one. And it didn't feel more ambitious or more sophisticated like I would expect from a writer of that caliber, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the one thing that they did have that makes it, I mean, I guess it's a reflection of that, you know, telling it over the course of a whole season, was that it was a little bit more patient as far as character arcs. And so, you know, particularly the Picard arc, I think, really is spread out over the whole season instead of, you know, having everything wrapped up within a single episode or anything like that. And I liked that. I liked the fact that, you know, and so I think essentially what has happened, we can talk about without spoilers, is that Picard, in the years since we've seen him, there's like a big mission that he wanted to lead for Starfleet, and Starfleet let him down, and as a result he sort of quit in a huff or in protest, and he's retreated from the world since then. And a lot of the show, I think, is about Picard becoming the Picard we know again. And I thought that was mostly like an effective thing. I mean, in some ways, it was a little bit too formulaic by the end to sort of get him back to what we already know. But mm-hmm. I did think that the handling of the character was good. I think some people have maybe been unhappy with the show because they don't like the fact that he, you know, that he's just not, that the Picard in general on Next Generation is the person you could rely on to do the right thing. And he would be sort of, he was like the voice of reason, the calm one, the captain that you always wanted. And he's not that here. He still, I mean, I think it's sort of in a pinch will do the right thing, but he's much crankier. A lot of the cast consists of people who he's let down in various ways.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't have that kind of reassuring feeling of Next Generation, but it is in some ways, I think, more moving than when he has to really fight to get back there.
Yeah, that's, I like that. I didn't really think of it that way, but I do like that part of it. I was doing that thing where you conflate, you know, actor and character. And I was just like, oh yeah, this seems like Patrick Stewart. But you're right, it doesn't really seem like Picard in the way that he was presented in TNG, or like he doesn't have a lot of the same defaults that he was afforded in that series, right? Where he was kind of like default listened to and respected by all, and looked up to by all. And then this, you're right, the characters that are assembled around him either have no reason to trust him or have to be convinced, or have specific reason to distrust him, which is an interesting dynamic for him to take on, especially. And they do, you know, like make a big deal of this, or like not make a deal of it, but make it part of the plot now that he's retired and quite a bit older, right? I mean, I think he's supposed to be, how old?
They said 90, like, I think. Something,
yeah,
around
95
90.
Or 93 or something, yeah. Which I remember they mentioned that, and I was like, what? Okay.
It's the future,
yeah. People are very well preserved, so.
He is well preserved, although I do think, I mean, one of the weird things about Patrick Stewart is that, and beautiful things about Patrick Stewart is the fact that when he started on Next Generation, he was already in his mid-40s, he was bald, and so there was some, you know, that some of the obvious signs of aging aren't things that happen. And so in some ways it almost seems like he's ageless, and sort of superficially you compare Patrick Stewart in, I don't know, 2010 and Patrick Stewart in 1987, you wouldn't necessarily notice any huge differences. But in this, I think you can really see that he is significantly older, and not in a way that I think is bad necessarily, but it's clear that he's not the person who he was when he was in Star Trek 25 or 30 years ago.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, he definitely does appear older. I had to Google it because I wasn't sure how old he actually was. He's 79, but yeah, I think it's effective in the way that it's presented in this series, right? And it's definitely like, it's different than, because I know another way where he used this to his advantage in terms of the portrayal was in Logan, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But it's a very different use of that. So it's cool because it's not just like, you know, oh, older guy, typical kind of like problems that come with age. It's like, at least between those two presentations, you can see, I mean, he's just still Patrick Stewart. He's doing a great job, and he's like playing up the aspects that he can't change. Like, he's an older person, but to very different effect in both of these those presentations.
By the way, this is a little bit of an aside, but I can't help but mention that before Logan came out, you specifically created a channel in Slack, or I can't remember if it was you or Greg, but you were part of it, to yell at me for not being excited about Logan.
Oh yeah,
and that channel still exists. Brian Heater and I are the only two people who have not, you know, pulled the Band-Aid off and left. But occasionally we'll just post GIFs in there.
What's it called?
X23.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. Oh, that's great. Thanks.
And I was completely wrong. I mean, Logan is quite possibly my favorite superhero movie. So that is one where I totally whiffed it. I thought the trailers didn't look that good, and that movie is amazing.
Yeah.
And Patrick Stewart is very good in it.
Very good. And not to, this is even further afield, but like, thinking back to Logan now, and then thinking to all the like praise heaped on Stupid Joker, it's like, whoa, did you guys miss Logan? Like, what, come on.
I agree that like, I mean, I don't think there's only one way to do quote unquote adult superheroes, but Logan is good in almost every way that Joker is bad.
Yeah. Okay.
So good. In Picard, good one of the things they Picard. Do is they surround, they say, so there are actors from Star Trek, specifically from Next Generation, but also, I mean, this is, again, not a spoiler because it's in the marketing, Jerry Ryan, who played Seven of Nine and Voyager, is in it. But the main cast is this sort of new crew who Picard assembles over the course of several episodes. Did you feel like these characters were compelling?
They were all very interesting. I think one thing they did here that is different from a lot of existing Star Trek shows and kind of the model that they have adopted is make all of them have a very full life and personality. That's not to like say anything necessarily good or bad about the people portraying them, but like they were fully written, I think, each of them, as opposed to being like, oh, here's like, you know, it's the comms person or the person who's always on the away team who kind of like accidentally gradually develops a presence in the show. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. I mean, like, I think about the fact that as an Asian American, Sulu is like a character who's incredibly important to me. Like, George Takei is a hero of mine. If you ask me to describe what kind of person Sulu was, I don't know if I could say much about him.
No, I mean, off the top of my head, I just think of fencing.
Right, like, exactly. He likes fencing. He eventually becomes a captain. He's loyal to Captain Kirk. He seems like a guy who has like a good time. He seems like happy most of the time.
Yes.
I see him. But otherwise, yes. I couldn't really say much.
No,
whereas
yeah, that's
I could
true.
Describe all the characters here. I mean, you know, and I think there is a little bit of a trade-off because one of the things about both original Star Trek and Next Generation, I think, is that it works really well as comfort viewing, which is not to say that it doesn't have cool new ideas and it's not you know, stimulating in some ways, but that there's something about spending time with that crew, with those two crews, where you just feel at home. At least I do. I think that's true of a lot of Star Trek fans. And you don't get that here. I mean, the characters, I think, are more memorable, but you don't have that kind of attachment to them as a crew. Although some of that may just be because we're only 10 episodes in, and I don't know if I would have said that about either of the original series or Next Generation crews 10 episodes in.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I feel like there were some really intentional attempts to to present them as like a gelled crew or whatever, or like, you know, like that's kind of part of the arc of the whole show, is getting them together and turning them into a crew. But I don't know that it ever actually does accomplish that. Like, in the end, it does still, to me, feel like a collection of individuals, and I'm not really sure how they're going to proceed, or I don't know that I'm invested in them remaining together as a group. You know what I mean? Which is different, right? I think, from other Star Trek shows.
Right. There is, without maybe saying who is in this shot, there's sort of this this final shot of the crew together as a crew, and it seems like we're meant to be very invested in this idea, and I was not. I was definitely like, I don't know, like, maybe I could imagine like half of these people going off and doing their own thing. I don't really understand why they're on this ship, or what is actually going to happen on this ship now that this main storyline is over. Like, what do they have? A mission? Do they have a goal? What's going on?
Yeah. I mean, in a way, that's kind of like it's almost a more Star Trek vibe, or Star Wars vibe. God, why do I keep doing this? I actually mean Star Wars this time, where they've established everybody kind of in their own right. And then you imagine them kind of like variously splitting off and then coming back together as they go about various foibles and side plots and subplots and whatever, which is, to me, more Star Wars than Star Trek has ever been, which Star Trek seems to generally remain focused on, you know, one central, like, they change it up episode to episode, but generally it's like there's a few central characters, you focus on them, and then everything centers around them, and people kind of group and congregate around them, right?
Right, and that they're usually, if they're separated, they're separated for the course of an episode. Certain character might advance to the forefront for an episode, but fundamentally it's like, hey, we're all on this ship, on this space station together, and trying to accomplish the same thing, and we're all kind of moving in the same direction.
Yeah, yeah.
And so in some ways it felt like it was sort of trying to take what was more of a Star Wars-ish setup and then forcing it into a sort of more Star Trek mold at the very end.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, that might be oversimplifying it, but sure. I do get that vibe, because, yeah, I think there's just something distinctly, it's weird because if you were to like have this thing described and look at the IMDb page and then look at it versus Discovery, not to keep comparing them, but like this one should have all the ingredients to be a much more traditional Star Trek outing. And I think in some ways, and I alluded to it in terms of like what I felt like was the depth of the plot, or like the sophistication of the story. Like, I think it is that, and that's not a compliment. And then in other ways, I think it's like very much not a traditional Star Trek story, just in terms of the way that the crew is presented, and the way that like they work together, and the way that Picard operates relative to them, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Should we move into spoilers? Because I feel like there's a lot of stuff I want to talk about in spoilers.
Yeah, let's do that. Yeah.
Okay. So if you have not seen the first season of Star Trek Picard and you don't want to get spoiled, you should stop listening now. And so I think there's sort of like these a couple of different blocks of episodes, essentially. The first one being the first few episodes that reintroduce Picard, and then very quickly connect him with this young woman named Dodge, who we learn fairly quickly is both, and I forget what, oh, well, synth is like the derogatory term. I don't remember. I don't know what is like the good way of saying it. I guess synthetics.
Yeah.
Basically, I think so. You know, a humanoid robot, like a completely convincing humanoid robot, which is maybe one of the first times we've seen that in Star Trek, because Data from Next Generation is much more artificial looking. And so she comes to Picard asking for help, is quickly killed in this attack, but then that sort of sends Picard looking for her sister, and partly because he realizes that both Dodge and her sister were made from, I don't know if I can explain this, but basically there was some piece of Data, his lieutenant from the android lieutenant from Next Generation, who was killed in Star Trek Nemesis, and that piece was basically used to create the consciousness of Dodge and her sister Soji. And just describing this, I feel like, wow, like, yeah, this show must be completely incomprehensible to anyone who hasn't seen Star Trek
before. Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, thinking back on it, there was a pretty winding road in, which was like, I thought engaging. Like, I think I was more engaged with the show at the beginning because there was a lot of questions and I felt like they were interesting questions. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of like, oh, yeah, like, what's happening? What's going to happen? What is the actual answer to this? And then once we started getting actual answers, I think I was less interested because I found the answers unsatisfying, I guess.
I didn't necessarily find the answers unsatisfying so much as they felt like the... I mean, I guess unsatisfying because they were the obvious answers. And so,
yeah,
you know, if you're like, oh, I wonder what this woman is and why this episode is so heavy on, you know, stuff about Data, you realize, oh, right, she's Data's daughter. Sure, that makes sense. And then one of the pieces of backstory, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit, is that the synthetics basically attacked the shipyards on Mars, and that is why synthetics have been banned since then. And you know, one of the questions to set up is like, what happened with the synthetics? And that is like dealt with in this really offhand way where they say, oh yeah, I think basically the Romulans had, I think, actually I may be getting this wrong, but I think they, because there's a group within the Romulans called the Tal Shiar who are very strongly against synthetic life. Mm-hmm. And so they staged this, somehow they got the, they basically staged like this attack so that with the specific intent of getting humans to ban synthetics. And it was just something that, like, it was set up as this, like, huge question, and then I feel like was sort of answered in a line of dialogue that no one really talked about afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, yeah. I didn't catch on to that, but yeah.
I may be getting some of the details wrong about that, but I think essentially that's what it is. So then what happens is Picard then sort of pulls his crew together. And I think a lot of people have said these. It's a weird thing that the first episode, I think, is really fast-paced because you're introduced to Picard, you're introduced to Dodge, you find out that Dodge, and then Dodge dies, you find out Dodge is Data's daughter, and then you also find out that there's this Borg cube which has been reclaimed in some way, and
right.
That is all in one episode. The whole time you're just like, what? And then the next couple episodes after that, the show really starts to slow down to, you know, it seems like it's a lot of setup. Picard,
yeah,
he's like meeting people, but he's not like, he doesn't actually get a ship until the end of the third episode. So it's sort of two more episodes of him kind of puttering around his vineyard and traveling around Earth.
Yeah, they throw a lot in, and then they kind of like go, okay, now we're going to slow down while we explain some of this stuff that we've like just thrown in there with very little explanation at the start. And they do that thing where they're like, here's another story and we'll connect the two, right? Like the Borg cube story. But yeah, I think this is what I was getting at with like uneven, right? Cause it is, and then you're right, they slow down and they kind of do like, they spend a lot more time than I thought they were going to spend with Picard at or leaving and then returning to the vineyard, right? Like, mm-hmm. I thought he was going to get out of there a lot faster and start doing space stuff. much more quickly. Or that conversely, there was never going to be any space stuff, but they instead like stretched it out. He like spends at least a few episodes doing the kind of like cliched assembling, getting the crew together, as the Rick and Morty episode recently put it. So like that also was a bit confusing in terms of pacing, because you're like, oh, I guess they're gonna, and then they're like, oh no, I guess they're not. Oh no, they are doing that.
But, right, because there's one, like, I remember there was like one specific point where I thought, okay, now he's got a ship, so now they like, hey, there's actually somewhere he needs to go. And they're going to go to the Borg cube now, but instead he stops off at this Romulan planet to pick up somebody else named Elnor, who we've never met before. And there's like good backstory for it, but at the same time, we have no idea who this, you know, we have no emotional connection to this character. He's also basically space Legolas, which everyone on Twitter has pointed out.
Yes. Oh yeah, that's right. He really is.
I mean, I just like what... I mean, I find the actor who plays Elnor kind of charming, because he really plays him like an idealistic young man in a way that's, again, charming. But like the idea of this guy who's running around with a sword on what eventually is like a Borg ship doesn't make any sense at all.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. You know, because they try to establish, they like give you, and they spend a lot of time on making sure that there is a justification, which maybe only makes the justification seem more hollow, right? Like when they explain the Romulan order or whatever that he belongs to.
Right. Which is there's so many different Romulan orders in this show. Yeah. His is the Kawat Milat, which I think is the one that's maybe intentionally sounds the most like something out of Dune. And it's this like matriarchal order, and they believe in absolute candor, which is actually a really fun thing, where he just, you know, will say the most direct thing, even if it's completely inappropriate.
I can't think of, I help but think of radical candor when they bring that up, which is like, you know, a horrible Silicon Valley management technique cliche that is going, basically just an excuse for rich white people to be assholes. But like the thing in the show is used, I think it's actually, it's quite good in like his, Picard's interactions with his old friends from it, not the young guy. Like it's less effective with the young guy, and they don't, they do a little bit with it, and it does make for some of the funnier moments in the show. So I shouldn't knock it too much, because it is, it's good and it's funny. It's just like, to me, a little bit like the kind of like Drax taking everything 100% literally, but maybe not used as comedically or whatever. So it's maybe like a little bit of a washed out version of that. But, and I think it's interesting that they bring up this whole subculture, and like they do a decent job of trying to like flesh it out, I'd say, without making it so obvious that that's what they're doing. Like it still seems like it's like, oh yeah, of course Picard would go to find out something from like his Romulan connections about this Romulan conspiracy theory that's going on. They build it up a lot, and they don't do that much with it, except for a setup that the guy is a elf with a sword or whatever that fights.
Right. Really, I mean, it's so, I mean, visually, I mean, he has that long hair. He has the point. I mean, it's sort of, I can't imagine that anyone, you know, looking at this guy in costume, even just on the set, was like, not like, this is an elf. This is absolutely Legolas.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. It was a weird choice. They could have just like given him short hair or something. I don't know.
Right. Or not a sword, or I don't know, any number of things. Although I guess, I mean, technically Legolas had a bow and arrow, but you know, it was still this sort of anachronistic sword and sorcery kind of weapon.
So
after they get Elnor, there's this episode which really focuses on the ex-Borg. I mean, there's sort of a thread through the whole episode, but this is like, I'm thinking of the episode where Seven of Nine comes back.
Yeah.
And it opens with what I think might be the most disgusting scene in any Star Trek show, where there are these people who are harvesting mechanical parts from former Borg. And so you see, like, basically this person getting all the mechanical stuff getting pulled out of his face, and it's his eye. And I was just like screaming during the entire scene.
Wait, was that the one? Are you talking about the one where they're doing it on the cube or the one where they're doing it in the flashback?
In flashback, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that one was really
close. Seven of Nine shows up and she like kills all the like criminals, but also then kills her friend because he has lost so much that he's not going to survive anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's who I was thinking about earlier, that apparently he was a character on Voyager, but I never saw that his episodes of Voyager, so I didn't care. But I still felt like it was a really upsetting scene.
Oh, is that what he was from?
Yeah, I guess they find this whole crew of, like, he's, I guess, one of the first ex-Borg, because they find this whole, like, cube of Borg who have been separated from the larger collective and are able to rehabilitate them. And so, like, that's why she has this very strong kind of motherly instinct towards him, because she was the one who, I guess, who like welcomed him back into the human race. And then Picard killed him off in 5 minutes at the beginning of an episode.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. I didn't know. I mean, that's where my knowledge kind of falls down. Right.
No, I didn't know that either until a friend was like, I was so upset that they killed, I think his name's Icheb. And I was like, I don't, whatever you're saying, this means nothing to me.
Yeah, I mean, I felt that way about a lot of the X-Borg stuff, which I don't know what that says about. Mm-hmm. But I was kind of like, I don't really care what happens to these ones, they also treated them. I mean, they treated them like essentially mindless drones, even though they were now free from the collective in the show, right? Like they were like
it was hard sometimes to tell whether they were meant to be part of a collective or not.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Because I think their whole thing was in the fiction that they could like free them from the collective, but then they were somewhat aimless once they were free from that. But then they did seem to have some kind of link or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah. I did think, I mean, Jeri Ryan, who I remember watching like her early episodes of Voyager and thinking like the character of Seven of Nine was very compelling, but also I was a teenage boy, and so I think there were some other reasons why maybe I enjoyed seeing her on the screen in this very tight catsuit than the quality of her acting. But here she seems really good. I really think she, like, that's the main reason that I was interested in the X-Borg story, was because I thought she and then the actor who plays Hugh, who is also another former Borg, I thought they both did. I don't think they were like amazing masterclasses of acting, but I thought they were compelling characters with good performances.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that, yeah, she was definitely memorable for other reasons, and I think that was by design by the showrunners at the time. But like, they did a good job. And I did find Hugh's sort of arc and acting genuinely affecting. I think he was good. I think especially among, like, in the context of relative performances from everybody, I thought he was pretty good. So nothing against him. Yeah, we're in the spoilers, I guess. So like, yeah, when he died, like that was good. It was like a genuinely affecting part of the plot. So yeah. And also Jeri coming back was interesting, because I thought she was gone. I thought she would just come in to do that cameo.
Yeah.
And then she came back, what, a couple episodes later or something like that?
Right.
And
yeah.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, it was sort of, I feel like I like that they brought people back and it wasn't just like a one episode thing, both with her and with Riker, who we'll get to him in a minute. I thought that they still didn't necessarily give her enough to do, because she gets there after Hugh dies. And I thought his death was genuinely really affecting, although it's also done in this kind of weird, offhanded way where he's not even part of the main fight, but just sort of watching, and then they throw a knife in his direction and he gets killed. Yeah. But his actual death scene, I thought, was well done. But then the Borg storyline, basically, once Picard has been to the ship and found Soji, the other Data's other daughter, and escaped from there, the Borg storyline kind of doesn't go anywhere. They basically, there's a lot of fighting. Hugh dies. Seven of Nine shows up. 709 becomes the queen of the Borg cube very briefly, and then they never talk about it again. And then the Borg cube eventually crashes on the planet where the whole show ends, or the whole season ends. But it doesn't play a role in the finale. So it kind of is a lot of windup that doesn't pay off in any meaningful way.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's going to go somewhere in future. I think it's going to be an ongoing concern, and there's going to, because doesn't it like still exist? There's still XBs mm-hmm. on it, or Borgs on it, or something, right? Like it crashed the planet, but then it survives there. Because isn't that the main thing, that what's her name is going to stick around and like try to be their mother or something? Am I getting that wrong?
No, because she's on the ship at the end.
Oh, is she? Okay.
Is on the ship with Picard, and she's one of those people where, like, I don't understand why you're going with Picard rather than staying with all these ex-Borg if that's what is motivating you.
Yeah. Okay, I got that wrong. I don't know. That it's a bad sign. That wasn't very memorable to me. But, like, I don't know. I think in part, it seemed kind of not a great use of that. Like, it seemed all set up just to be a kind of like a Deus Ex thing that they could just bring in to turn the tide when they were being chased by the Romulan assassin or whatever, because mm-hmm. that's basically the functional purpose it played in the last kind of arc, right? Was to show up and save the ship, their ship, and then after that it was kind of worthless or whatever. Well, it provided an arena for Peyton List to kind of get her comeuppance, other Romulan assassin, right? Nerissa, I guess, right?
Yeah.
So there was that, but you're right. It didn't do much, and it seemed like a lot to do that. I think conceptually what's interesting about it, and they didn't really do enough about this, except maybe just leave it out there for you, the viewer, to pick up, was like that they are the meeting point of these two things that are at odds, right? Because the main conflict is like synthetics and humans, right? And like, can we live together or whatever? And these are like the half synthetic, half human, the cyborg connective tissue. But they don't really do anything with that except for have them all involved in the mix, I guess, right?
Yeah. Hopefully they'll figure out some more interesting stuff to do in the second season. But, and I mean, it wasn't that. I thought just the core idea of this reclaimed Borg cube, where there's this whole society of scientists trying to research it, but sort of being overseen by the Romulans. That was all interesting. And you know, that was probably one of the things that got me through what felt like a bit too much of like Soji and this Romulan Narek just having their relationship and Soji wondering about her past in a way that kind of went on for too long. But I liked it because I got to see the glimpses of this larger world of the reclaimed Borg cube, or I guess they call it the artifact. And so that's, so Picard does eventually arrive on the artifact. He meets up with Soji, and then because I guess the Borg cube has some sort of magical thing that sends you elsewhere, he gets transported to this planet, Nepenthe, which is where Will Riker and Deanna Troi are living. And this was probably my favorite episode, even if I sort of recognized that it was just, in a lot of ways, just pure fan service and nostalgia. But there's pretty much a full hour of Picard and Riker and Troi hanging out, and I just thought it was great.
Yeah, that was good. But it was funny, the mechanic for how they got there was like, oh yeah, there's a portal. There's essentially a Stargate on this Borg cube. What? Yeah, they all have them for the Queen. Like, it's a later edition. Remember they went into, they added it after you guys did all this stuff.
Which, to be fair, I think Star Trek has a lot of these things where they're like, let's introduce this one thing and then never mention it, speak of it again. I really am not crazy about, but, like, it does happen. And, like, I mean, the biggest example that I can think of was, like, in the new Star Trek movies where suddenly you can just teleport anywhere in the universe. And thought that was like insane that they did that. It's like, why do you even need spaceships for it?
Just
teleport to the planet, you know, Klingon. Like, there's no point in having spaceships. This is so stupid. And then they just never bring that up. And there's nothing here quite on that level, but there is some stuff where it does feel like, all right, here's the thing. Don't worry about it.
But you're right. They do that, and they have, you know, it's a very comic book logic thing to do, right? Like, it's like, how do we kill Galactus? Oh, well, the ultimate nullifier or whatever, right? Like, what?
Yeah. Okay. And then we'll just put the ultimate nullifier away. And
yeah.
we won't bring it up again unless Galactus comes back, in which case... Yeah. We'll have a line of dialogue about why we can't use the ultimate nullifier this time, or we'll shoot off the ultimate nullifier and it won't work.
Yeah, that's great. So I think
Frakes and Jonathan Frakes and Marina Sirtis, I feel like they were never bad actors, but they were never the standout actors in the Next Generation cast. And I feel like they've gotten better in the meantime.
I think so too. I think, I don't know. I don't know if it's just like, because they spent so much time with those characters, and like now they just might be able to, like, you with the advantage of some time away from it, some distance away from it, you can just kind of relax into it, and it really is like you're just slipping into an old skin. And like, I don't know, there's something about it where they feel very comfortable and familiar, but they also feel like they super inhabit that, right? In a way that maybe they didn't before, where it seemed like they were just kind of walking around reading a script or whatever. Cause you're right. Like, they're, you know, whatever else you can say about them, especially Frakes, I would say, like, he wasn't really doing that much.
he was just trying to be kind of charming, and he had to wear some very silly costumes, which everyone did. But I guess his tended to be a lot more about like chest hair. And then he played the trombone, I think, or some sort of instrument.
Oh, did he? Oh, God.
Yeah.
Well,
there's gifts. Don't worry.
Yeah, there's lots of gifts of him, and I think most of them are reflective of, you know, they're not positive comments on the nature of his acting abilities.
Right. Although I don't think they're also like Jonathan Frakes is bad. They're just like, yeah, if you on this show, you can make Jonathan Frakes look very silly.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Yeah,
there's a certain way that he gets into a chair, which is ridiculous, but
here it was great, and they really did sell it. Like, everybody, it felt like you could feel the intervening years, right? Because in a way you can, because they actually did spend all this time apart, you know, like as people. So
and conversely, I get the sense that, you know, I mean, partly because aside from Patrick Stewart, and I mean, I think Frakes has had a pretty busy career as a director, but not as an actor, is that, you know, these are all people who are also on the convention circuit, and so they all run into each other, and so there's like a real affection, both from their time together on the show, but also afterwards. So it feels like when they're on screen together, there's this kind of very easy chemistry that they step into. So after he sort of, Picard kind of gets his shit together, is sort of reminded of who he is on Nepenthe, we enter the last three episodes of the season, which, again, there's some stuff I like, I really like the idea of Seven of Nine becoming the Borg Queen again. I just wish that there'd been more consequences of that rather than just being this cool moment.
It was just useful, and then...
Yeah.
Oh, wow, weird. That's done now. Okay.
Yeah. And then once they get to this, planet, it's Coppelius, and it's the planet of all the synthetics who've been built by this guy, Bruce Maddox, who we met earlier in the season, and then he dies very quickly. And it turns out the son of Soong, who is the person who created Data, they've built this society of synths, and I really wanted this to be good. And it just felt like this very cheesy Star Trek planet that, like, they clearly just went to this office park and, you know, shot. I mean, I don't actually know if it was at all an office park, but it was just this very generic set, this very kind of generic Star Trek world. And none of the synthetics are that interesting. And they also, again, like, this is the comic book logic that we were talking about. Like, then they just reveal in passing that one of the synthetics has developed the power to... She's studied the Vulcan mind meld, and so she can do the mind meld herself. Yeah. Which is a minor plot point, but just seemed really silly.
Yep. It was, another classic, like, for convenience sake, and because we can't figure out how else to pass on this information that this one character has that we need these other characters to have. Right, like, it's You're right. Like when they get there, everything starts to feel very, a lot more formulaic Star Trek. From the sets that are, yeah, like pseudo futuristic with some gowns and like some pretty picturesque. Yeah, you're right. Like Office Park, I don't know, Northern California vibe or something, right? And then to the, yeah, like the mechanics of how we actually make the plot happen. Like it's not advanced, and they got doubles of everybody running around, and they just have the gold stuff that like that Data used to wear, that Brent Spiner used to wear to make his skin look somewhat artificial. Like that's how you discern, I guess, the true synthetics or the synthetics that are older and more robot looking. I don't really know how they did that versus the ones who have normal eyes and skin tones. But
I think they're supposed to be older models before they figured out how to recreate human skin tones. But none of that's stated. That's just sort of what my guess is.
Yeah.
And so basically what happens then is it sets up this conflict where the synthetics on this planet, through this mind meld, they figure out that... So the Romulans have been really obsessed with this thing called the admonition, which they think is a warning by this ancient race that if you create synthetics, the synthetics will rise up and destroy you inevitably, and that this ancient race is still somewhere outside beyond the galaxy waiting for this to happen. They'll come and destroy you if you create synthetic life. What the synthetics figure out is actually this message was not meant for organic life, which is why all the Romulans who've connected to the admonition telepathically generally go insane, which is actually a really great scene where they show like one Romulan woman just like ripping her hair out, another one just starts bashing her head in with a rock, and it's like genuinely pretty frightening. But it turns out that the admonition is meant for synthetics, and it's basically saying yes, human and synthetic life will inevitably come into conflict, and so if you are synthetic life, call us essentially, and we will come and destroy all the human, all the organic life that threatens you.
Yeah.
And so meanwhile, there are Romulans rushing to this planet. And so it's sort of setting up this conflict where the synthetic, this mysterious synthetic army and the Romulans are going to go to war, and who knows who's going to win. Is it going to wipe out all organic life? And instead what happens is naturally Picard, after a not very effective speech, and he's in prison, but then he gets freed. There's like a magical device that allows him to pull off this maneuver with his ship where it looks like there are many more ships. But then I think the crucial thing is he gets to talk to Soji and tells her, you know, don't do this. Don't call these mysterious tentacled robots from beyond the galaxy. That's a really bad idea.
Yeah, yeah.
And trust us and we'll trust you, essentially. And it's a very sort of classic Picard moment. And she does eventually do that. So there's this, and then Riker shows up in a ship, which is also great. Like, it's just awesome to see him on the bridge of a ship again. And I started crying.
Yeah. It was good.
I mean, I think there's so many things in the finale to make fun of. And also I cried multiple times.
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was really good. And it obviously, yeah, it had cheesy moments and whatever, but like that's Star Trek. Star Trek's going to have cheesy bits, and that's part of the appeal of it, right? So
yeah, maybe I think the cheese quotient was a little higher than I wanted, especially in a modern show, versus if I watch a show from the 60s, I know that like that's part of the era, or even from the 80s, part of the era, versus like in 2020, I'm like, I think we can do a little better, guys. But yeah. I agree. Yes, it was still, the emotional stuff still really hit. And then Picard is, I think partly because in order to get through this crisis, he took some sort of drug that has accelerated this brain condition that we already knew he had. And so he dies. But then, and we get like multiple scenes of people grieving for Picard. But then we see that he actually, his consciousness has survived and is somehow connected to the same consciousness, Data's consciousness, that has been preserved to create these new synthetics. And so Data and Picard have a final scene together where they sort of can express all the love and gratitude that they feel towards each other. And then Data says, like, you're actually going to go back, and you're going to go back to life. And the one thing I want you to do when you do that, the one way you can repay me is I need you to kill me. I want you to delete this, quantum drive that I'm stored on. And so then you get this scene of Picard. First, he like wakes up in this synthetic body, and that his consciousness has been downloaded into, but it's like sort of an identical body to his old body, minus the brain abnormality.
Yeah.
And there's a scene where he basically is like erasing the computer that Data is on, and this is one of the other scenes where I just completely lost my shit at this, where they're playing the song Blue Skies, which is the, I guess, a song that Data sings in Star Trek Nemesis. I have no intention of ever rewatching that movie, so I don't know exactly what role it plays. but you see like Data in this virtual world preparing for death, and this sort of avatar of Picard sitting there holding his hand as he dies, and it's amazing.
Yeah, and he ages too. I thought that was a bold choice. As they remove the like cores, he like ages, which was part of what he requested, right? Because he wanted to like live a real life or whatever. So,
right, and that's, I mean, I don't know if this is the only place you get that idea, but there's a story by Isaac Asimov that was then turned into a Robin Williams movie, which I refused to see, called The Bicentennial Man, where it's kind of the same idea, where there's a robot who, over time, you know, replaces more and more of himself with organic parts and becomes more and more human, and is able to feel emotion, and they still will not accept him as a human being. They say, no, you're still a robot. And he realizes at the end that the one thing that humans have that he doesn't have is the knowledge that they will die one day. And so by like committing suicide, essentially, he is finally recognized as human. And I think in a lot of ways, this is kind of a parallel of that idea.
Yeah. 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 It was good. I mean, the stuff with him, his body transfer, there's a lot there that was like, you really could have just not made this quite so pat and clean. And like they've telegraphed it, first of all, by having this like golem. They kept referring to that. And I was like, why do you want to bring up that specific imagery? I guess so.
I think it's because Shaban's obsessed with golems.
Oh, okay.
So that's why he just wanted to call it that.
It's like, it's not made from his like feces or other human excrement or anything like that, right? Like, aren't they made from like the like
dirt, I think, is what humors? It is. Dirt and hair, maybe? I think dirt and then the human hair. I think it may depend on the, but yeah, definitely a lot of like not that sanitary organic matter.
Yeah, it's just a weird analogy to bring up if you're not going to do much with it except for like a consciousness transfer, which then also like the bounds of it that you said are like, no, don't worry, it's an exact biological body that has all the same characteristics, including estimated lifespan, minus this inconvenient thing where you would have had to die right away. Like, what? Just give him something. Like, make it have some other consequence as opposed to that, right? So,
and I mean, I think the thing about it was that in the episode before, when it's very clear that Picard is accelerating towards his death, and they keep having shots of this synthetic body that at the time has been constructed for Soong's son to download himself into, you're like, oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah.
Okay, sure.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's a bad direction. And I think it's really speaks also to the fact that one of the things I think is really good about the show is that it takes synthetic life a lot more seriously than a lot of Star Trek series have. Like, the idea of robots rebelling and maybe the robots are right is something that I don't think would have necessarily occurred in any other Star Trek show. But, and so that stuff is theoretically really good, but the problem is that it feels also like very kind of neat and convenient. And I guess particularly because Star Trek has this pattern of so many of its major deaths ultimately are reversed,
right,
that it seems like just part of that pattern of like, okay, let's have 5 minutes of people crying about Picard, drinking toast to Picard, and then immediately having him come back to life. I have all these intellectual objections to these last two episodes, and I think that a lot of people have criticized them, and if they said that to me, I'd be like, yes, you're right, all this stuff is correct. but they also completely worked. And well, not completely, but like all the big stuff totally worked for me and like was emotionally satisfying and put me through the ringer and all of that.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. I think it was a thing where like you could definitely see it coming and you're like, it's, in some ways it's a bit of a cheap way out, right? When it would have been a totally different kind of affecting and probably like, you know, more powerful as a one-off to actually have him pass away in this one, right? But like that would have been very different and it wouldn't have set you up for anything else. And they did have Data, like that was genuinely moving, and that doesn't seem like something they're gonna seek to undo, although who knows.
Well, because I mean the whole season is essentially an undoing, a partial undoing of Data's death, just so that they can give him a different death scene this time.
Yeah,
so right. I think in that sense it seems pretty ridiculous that they would try to do it again, but
yeah,
you know, life is long, there's a lot of episodes of Star Trek shows, anything could happen.
Yeah but yeah, on the whole, I mean, I don't know, I think it was good, and I don't know what I would have done differently, even if I'm criticizing the way they went about it, right? Like it's fine, and I think that I think that if you were, if I was closer to the age when I watched a lot of Star Trek content, I probably wouldn't have felt even less about those things that disappointed me. You know, I would have just been like, yeah, this feels like right. You know, because it's like, imagine if I went back now and looked at the Next Generation with the kind of similar like critical eye that I bring to things today. I feel like that would be not a good experience, and like subtract out, you know, the emotional baggage, and that's something I think I've tried most often to do, or most seriously to do with like Star Wars, right? Like the original Star Wars movies, because that's kind of the classic case of like, no, this, you just have too much of your identity bound up in this. But if you actually took it objectively and looked at it, you realize like they're very hard to access for a modern audience, and they're very goofy, and like there's things that you just can't forgive, right? So I feel like it's kind of similar to this, and I think, I don't know, I guess they made a show that was very Star Trek in a lot of ways, even though we've talked about a lot of ways that it's not, and those ways are gonna be maybe difficult for new audiences who have different expectations about what modern serious sci-fi storytelling should be like. Though that I would find it hard to maybe enjoy this, but as a Star Trek fan and knowing their kind of pedigree, I loved it, and I thought the ending was great, and I'm excited for more episodes too.
Yeah, I agree with all that, and I think in some ways it just still does update Star Trek in some crucial ways that I think are really important to appreciating it, you know, in 2020. But I think also that certainly if somebody is coming to Star Trek fresh, I would probably recommend, I mean, I think probably what I would really recommend is you just watch the movies, which have their own problems, but in general, I think are not quite as uneven as the shows can be, and are just less of a commitment, and you get to see both Picard and the Kirk crews. But if you want to watch a new show, I would probably say Discovery is not necessarily a better show, but a more accessible show.
Yeah, definitely more accessible.
Well, should we wrap things up there? Do you have any final thoughts?
I mean, I feel like we didn't do anybody else enough justice in terms of talking about how they played, but yeah. I don't want to get too into it. Like, I mean, I feel like Alison Pill it's really interesting to watch Alison Pill in this and then simultaneously be watching Alison Pill in Devs. But I won't say too much about that. I think I enjoy her in both for different reasons. Although one shared element is this sort of like her ability to be somewhat unsettling, I think. And then the other one that I had lots of thoughts about, but I'm not sure what thoughts, it was like, San Diego Cabrera as Rios, Captain Rios.
And well, not just as Rios, but also as every single one of the emergency holograms on the ship.
Yeah, that is the main thing that has me like, well, why did they choose to do this? This is a weird decision that they made.
I liked it. I thought, I mean, it was a very kind of silly and flashy. Let's have this actor show off in a not particularly subtle way. Because, I mean, they're all very broad performances where he's doing, like, different accents or different mannerisms.
Yeah.
But it was fun. I thought it was fun. I really, you know, Rios at first seemed just sort of like a generic Han Solo kind of character. But as the show went on, I feel like he really grew on me. And I think probably the first time I really got a clue to that was just the way he's playing all these other characters. Which, and I mean, we really get the most time we spend with him is on a storyline that is kind of Rios-centric and trying to figure out why he's having this reaction to this woman for these, you know, and it's because of something that happened in his past.
Right, right. Yeah. I guess I agree with that. I think I had some questions. I mean, I get the it is fun to have him be like these broad characters. I do think the central character itself is like a little bit over the top and flat in a different, in a way that is, that doesn't make it as much sense because he's not a computer program, but like, yeah, I don't know. It, like his cigar smoking, I'm a closed book, moody thing is, I think, a little bit overdone in ways that it makes sense to overdo the rest of the characters, but the, like the actual human character, I feel less, you know, less good about that performance. Although maybe it turns out that he's a computer program too in a future season or something.
I don't think I want that.
No.
All right. The one other thing I should mention now, because I've obviously been I've had the Wikipedia page for Star Trek Picard open the whole time we've been talking, just to help me out. And one thing I realized is I was talking about how many secret Romulan orders there are on this show, and one of the things I realized is I mistakenly said that the Tal Shiar want to kill all the synthetics, but that is wrong. The Tal Shiar are one group of secret Romulan agents, but the other group of secret Romulan agents is the Jat Vash, and they're the ones who want to kill all the synthetics. So
the Tal Shiar are just like the secret agents, basically, right?
And then the Jat Vash are the anti-robot secret agents.
Who are within the Tal Shiar, but also maybe extend beyond them?
I don't know the exact relationship.
Right. But those two, because like, what's his name? Nervin? What's, no, it's not Nervin. That sounds
like... Narek?
Narek. And
his sister, Narissa.
Right. Oh, yeah. I forgot that they're brother and sister.
Right. Who either are sleeping together or really want to sleep together.
Yeah. Which is another weird note that they put in there. But they're both part of both of those agents or groups, I believe. Right.
Okay. Sure. I think you're right. Because I think most people don't even know that the Jat Vash exists, whereas they know the Tal Shiar exists.
Yeah. And then the other Jat Vash is the one who's the double agent inside the Federation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Commodore O. Yeah, that's right. Okay. Oh, that does clear it up. I did definitely conflated those two and didn't notice when they were referencing one versus the other. So
yeah. And I mean, I understand why they did that, because I think if they just said, oh, the Tal Shiar want to destroy all synthetic life, you'd be like, wait, we've seen episodes of the Tal Shiar that was that never came up. Why is this a thing now? So they had to invent a whole new secret order. But it also sounds kind of crazy when you say it out loud.
Yeah. And that, I mean, the show proves out that there's good reason that that secret order exists, right? I don't really know that there's much other takeaways. It's like, that should be there because these weird future synthetics or whatever do seem bent on destruction and only destruction of biological life, right? Like, they're not like, we'd like to negotiate. They're like weird Cthulhu-like tentacle monsters. That left a note that were like, just open a time portal and we'll come clean them out whenever you're ready.
Right. And so in a sense, yeah, I mean, I think that's a very Star Trek thing where I think secret societies that are like kind of in a gray moral area are not a very Star Trek-y, and at least in the sort of original series and Next Generation iterations. But what does feel very Star Trek-y is that even these very villainous and secretive characters have a valid reason for existing.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's true.
Are there any other characters we should shout out?
No, I mean, that does it for me. I mean, I could talk about it just about everybody else. I think of like the ensemble cast approach,
yeah,
really showed off that a lot of these folks are great and at least game, you know, like in that way of like everybody's here to have fun for a fun show. So I think I enjoyed that about it.
No, I liked it. It definitely did not quite live up to my hopes, but probably some of those hopes were not entirely realistic.
Yeah.
And I'm now we begin the cycle of perhaps creating unrealistic hopes about how much better it might get in a second season. But if you are a Star Trek fan, if you're a Patrick Stewart fan, I do absolutely recommend it. I think overall I'm glad this exists. And I'm looking forward to more. So with that, I will just remind listeners that they can always email us at originalcontent@techcrunch.com. Let us know what you think of Star Trek Picard. Let us know what you think of our review. We also appreciate it if you leave us a positive review in Apple Podcasts or any other podcast app. You can also subscribe in Apple Podcasts. And Daryl, I will talk to you soon.
All right. Yeah. Take it easy.